This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
So, Noah, thank you very much for your kind words. And I think I'm going in medias res. And, you know, there is something where films for me starting, and these are locations. So I like to be flaneur and to go around, and I look at the architecture or at places, and often really my films and the whole inspiration are starting with locations. And so it was like this with Prater in Vienna, and in another way, also with Exile Shanghai, and both places are in a way ex-territorial. They are exceptions. For Exile Shanghai, I don't know, maybe you could see this afternoon at least one part of it. I made this film in five portraits, and it is something about, it's like to reflect about history, and so five completely different people, Russian Jews, German Jews, Austrian Jews, going to Shanghai to escape. And they all were living exactly the same historical phase, and they are all telling a complete different story. And this is how you learn about history and how subjective history often is reported also and told. And this was a place in the 30s, late 30s, where you know, Shanghai didn't belong to the Chinese at that time. So it was the last time of this colonial phase. And the whole city was divided into the foreign powers. Yeah, the British, the Americans had a part, the French had another settlement, and so on. And everybody involved in World War II on both sides, yeah, were present, yeah, and this is like a model for all the problems of this special time were present, yeah, and this is why this was a fascinating place to talk about in a political way, yeah, also in a sociological way, where these people were living, and therefore it is an exterritorial place, of course, and also from the Chinese side at that time you had the fight between the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek, and you had not only the communists under Mao, you had all kinds of reform movements, and the young filmmakers, yeah, we don't want to shoot anymore at the studios, we want to shoot in the streets. And I saw a lot of these films of this time. So it was a highly fascinating city, yeah, under all aspects, yeah. And then to talk about Prater, you know, Prater As you know, that Sternberg and Stroheim both were, as young boys, living in Vienna near to the Prater. And they all went with 8, 10, 12, 14 years to the Prater, like all the other boys and girls you could see, and had this first important experiences of adolescence. And and all these famous topics, yeah, between the officer and the young girl coming from Schlesia or from the countryside. So these are the famous topics of both. And it goes through their films. If you know it, yeah, you can really see that it was the most important inspiration. And the Prater was such an inspiration for all the artists. Since more than 200 years, you have all the famous writers, you have all the composers who worked, the famous Strauss. They not have only done compositions for the Prater. They even conducted on the Prater themselves. And therefore, I included also some of the later film parts where you could see Leha playing for the little girls who have their holy communion, kind of confirmation. Yeah. So. But also all this, it is also a mirror of the time and the mirror of a society who were becoming, there were other entertainments were necessary when you have a big city. Before there were the markets, yeah, and you had it twice or three times a year, the kermes and all this. But then in a big city with all these young people coming from outside, they needed other kinds of entertainments, and it had to be available, always available. And this was very important. So it is also a mirror of a society in a metropolis. Yeah, and everything what was new immediately appeared on the Prater. Yeah, so when they developed the first light, what you see, ampoule, licht, lamps, yeah, the light. So even before they had light in the city, yeah, they made an electrical city at the Prater, yeah. And so it is also a history of all the inventions that people made, yeah, and it goes until now. Where it is influenced by the space shuttles and all this kind of things in a playful way. So these were the topics I got very interested. And then this, I don't know these words in English, Geisterbahn. Ghost trains, yeah. All this mise en scène in the ghost trains, you know, in a way they are like the Baroque altars, yeah. If you look at the structure, it has really this. And so also the, you know, when in earlier times only the corps diplomatique or the rich people could travel. So on the Prater, people went there and they could travel, yeah, in a little panoramic train from Vienna to Trieste or even to far away places. And they always knew that it is not real, but they had this pleasure to do it. Yeah, it was something of fantasy. And the big difference today is that it has no more so much to do with fantasy. It has more to do with an simulation, of reality, of a technical simulation. And I see the big difference and a really quite disturbing difference in this question. But no, it was just I had to give you some ideas around this and why I was especially interested.
So, Ulrika, it was so surprising somehow to see these kids in normal, everyday teenager garb in one of your films in such a fantastical setting. It really, because I'm so used to the figures in your fantastical worlds being dressed and made up and in a way that integrates them into those environments. Did you?
The ones who were on this rotor, with this rotation, these are mostly Russian kids. And I liked especially how they are playing with this machine and with the tricks of this machine. And I found this very interesting. And the other ones, this short film in Machismo, mm-hmm. Is the young Turkish guys, and then at the end a real boxer were coming and showed them how you have really to box. So, I found this unbelievable, And in the beginning it was interesting. They didn't see that they were so much in their play. They didn't see that I were filming. I found, these are these observations, little observations, and then you had these two very nice and timid guys from Indonesia, who just wanted to enjoy. And so I found it so interesting, these different things going on. And the elderly people, so there's a lot of widows, who have lost their husbands, and they are going dancing at the prater, And there's a lot of the quite well-off Turkish businessmen, who are often their partners. So everything what's going on, I found it very fascinating, what happened on the prater. And if you compare it with this Stroheim and Sternberg things, it has switched and changed, according to the times, and the change of the society. But there is something very going on, very similar to this.
So I think maybe we should just pause for a minute to take questions from the audience, and then we'll segue into some kind of a conversation. Does that make sense? Any questions from the audience or from the panelists? Mm-hmm.
Well, I have something to say about what we were just discussing, which is that you mentioned that at the Prater, everything new would appear there first, and the immigrants and the foreign visitors are also an example of newcomers who are appearing there, which is a connection back to Exile Shanghai in a way also. Anyway, it's just an observation.
Well, certainly the concept of extraterritoriality is a very, very rich one for thinking about your work. And it was occurring to me that the universal uniform of youth, jeans and T-shirts, etc., also constitutes a kind of, within the domain of dress, a kind of extraterritoriality, because as you were sitting next to me as we were watching Prater and saying, identifying people's, where people were coming from, but that was completely disguised in a strange kind of way by the way they were dressed. Anyway, that's a very rich concept, and I think it could be carried over into Still Moving as well. I don't know if you want to say anything about that work, which I think is really fantastic. Mm-hmm. In terms of this notion, because we have objects of various sorts commingling from different cultures, some of which are indigenous and others of which are orientalist or fabrications from elsewhere, but they've assumed a kind of life of their own that is extraterritorial as well. But yeah, Ulrika, do you want to say anything about this, about Still Moving?
Yeah, sure. You know, Still Moving, there was something, it was a coincidence, then the Arsenal asked me to, they were showing a lot of Jack Smith's films, and the Arsenal asked me to do a film, and I had carte blanche, I could do what I wanted to do. And so I were thinking, so I looked through my photos, and then it happened that at that time I finally went after my mother had died 2 years later, I went through the whole house where she had lived, where my the collection of my parents of art and African sculptures and all kinds of documents were there. My collection of art, because when I were living these 8 years in Paris, I had exchanged with a lot of painters and colleagues, artwork, of course, and my early paintings were there, and I went through this whole house, yeah, like through an archive, but I have also my own archive, and it's not an archive, it is something who is really lively, because I always taking things and bring them together. So I was thinking I should do with this something for this. So you had all this old, I had made with Tabea Blumenschein. We worked for a long time together. And I had made, I don't know how many photos, I think at least 5,000, 6,000 photos, yeah, of where she was always changing and everything. And we, it was a kind of play, yeah, and we have done this really very often. And I found this had something in the past, and then I found this wonderful little relics of a film, a Super 8 film from the birthday party of Lil Picard. I don't know if you know she's, but she also worked with Andy Warhol, and she was also a German immigrant to New York. And so I knew her since a very long time, and she made happenings too. So I found all these things and I brought them together. Yeah, it's I'm often working in this montage thing. So a lot of people say this is the film, the most personal, but this has to do that all this, you can identify all the elements, yeah? But in a way, they are always there in all my films, yeah? Probably in a more indirect way, but there, they are more direct, used in a more direct way.
What's probably the title in German?
It's the same.
It's the same.
Still Moving. Uh-huh. Yeah. I found it because it was what it
right.
was in many
with
senses.
The pun, with
in many yeah. senses. Yeah. It's a still. It's yeah. a still moving and so. Yeah. yeah. in all the senses. Yeah.
I mean, when I was watching it this time, I was really struck not only the way you were animating the inanimate objects visually through movement, but also with sound. So I was wondering if you can talk a little bit about the use of sound, and particularly music and songs, because that's almost throughout all of your work. I mean, even in Countdown, if I remember correctly, there were these wonderful dance scenes, again, of these older people who were sort of dancing. Yeah. So how music, it was almost like music as an animating force.
Yeah. Yeah, also in Prater and also in exile Shanghai, So, you know, the montage system goes also sometimes historically. So in exile Shanghai, I have taken all the, what you call, Ohrwürmer, you know, the famous things of the time. There's a word for it in English, I don't know.
Well, it would be literally earworm. Yeah.
So it was the famous things of the time. So I asked the immigrants, what did you take with you when you... And they told me all this unbelievable thing. And of course, there was a wonderful... Josef Schmidt, the great singer, who was, you might know, Ein Lied geht um die Welt, a song goes around the world. It was the famous song. When he arrived in the late 30s in New York with a ship, there were 10,000 people waiting for him and waving and greeting him. So he was also very famous in the States also. So I have these wonderful songs he made about, it was at the time when he had to leave Germany, and he talked about Heimatland and all these unbelievable songs. And he, it found at the same time the feelings of the people who had emigrated for different reasons, and then of course also the truth you had to leave. Yeah, and you know, the same is so the songs are always telling something. Today I was thinking I should have it's the last song in Prater is so important because it is like a conclusion of the whole film, and I should have translated it and subtitled it, because he gives some merry-go-round where you are always moving and staying on the same place, and it is a wonderful story he is telling. And this is considered to be the most famous song for Vienna and the most typical song for Vienna. And of course it was a Viennese Jew who had done this song and the lyrics and everything. So, and the same with a lot of other songs in Berlin. You have the Sportpalastwalzer. At that time they had the... Sieben Tage Rennen. You know, it was 7 days the cyclists went around, and you have all the artists, famous artists of the time, who went every night to have champagne and to look at these poor people going in the round. So it was a famous, famous song. And I took it for Exile Shanghai, when it starts with this. So also the songs and the music in my films is like the dialogue, or like a part, an important part, like in my films, you know, the elements are as important as the actors, the different elements. And I have a big collection of music, and I started very early. I have this shellac records I don't know if you see it also, shellacs, the very old ones. I have a big collection of this. And of at that time already, I went always to the ethnological archives to collect things. So in Madame X, you have the stick music of the Mato Grosso, and you know, so I used all this, yeah, and I made a new music, a new form out of it. So this is what I'm always doing. And even when I worked with Per Raben, this great composer of film music, you know, he had all my little records and elements, and we worked together. It was, by the way, one of the it was a wonderful work to work with him. He was so can you say as sensible, sensitive to everything. Yeah. It was great.
So so it's are, the roles of the panelists are somewhat undefined here. I'm not going to do an introduction.
Sorry,
well, I mean, I think having Ulrika here is, in a sense, enough, but I would like to bring Patty and Homé into the discussion, and Nora and I are
you
already
are right,
there.
Yeah.
So I thought that the invocation of Madame X might be a moment to bring Patty in. Just to say briefly, we represent Temple, Swarthmore, Bryn Mawr, and Penn. So that's a kind of wonderful, the four corners, so to speak, of the Academic Universe of Philadelphia. Patty has written about Madame X and Homé about Joanna d'Arc of Mongolia, and so...
You?
I've written about Bill de Sienkiewicz, yes. Right, I've written about Ticket of No Return, but I'm the moderator here. So I thought maybe Patty might be able to build some bridges for us between the earlier work and this work.
Well, it was really, it was amazing to see Still Moving, because the photo archive with Tobea Blumenschein was so evocative of the pleasure I had when I first saw Madame X, which was is a very collage, and the soundtrack is, I can hear it just thinking about the movie, because it's also post-synchronized sound, so the whole movie has this collage effect. But Blumenschein plays both the pirate queen, and she plays the figurehead that you saw in that really striking image of the pirate ship. And her masquerade, or her sort of spectacularness, seemed to me so much of the moment of Jack Smith, for example, of a kind of the campy and exuberant and gender performative queer avant-garde that usually doesn't consider women to be producers of that, but rather, you know, icons or participants.
Uh-huh.
And I could just see the person behind the camera looking at Tobea Blumenschein in those movies, and also because you're in that as a very wonderful little portrait of a lost figure. So it was really great to see Still Moving, and it felt to me that when it was united with these objects, that it, like Joanna most spectacularly, brings together this performative, campy, very carnivalesque, and fantastical world, and the ethnographic or on location sort of durational camera. That is all there in Joanna. But this little movie puts those elements together and kind of comes full circle. So that was really nice for me. And I don't know whether you want to say more about that but I was struck by your comment right now when you said, this seems like a personal movie, but those other movies are full of these personal things, but you just don't identify them as easily. And it feels to me that what you bring in your movies, whether they're collections of objects whose stories you're regaling us with now, or scenes of duration of a ritual or a place, are marked by the way you look at them. And so that's what I was wondering, if that's what's personal in a movie, say, like Prata, to have those elements. I mean, there's some clear elements of friends and performers and things that are in there. So I guess the big question I think probably the audience would like to hear is, can you talk about these two seemingly incongruous elements that then live together so, you know, delightfully in the movies that I've named? In Prater, I think, because it's carnivalesque and quotidian, you know, the subject matter. But certainly Joanna, which has these wonderful campy figures go to Mongolia and live in yurts and travel with nomads and transform their spatial, temporal everydayness in this great way. So, big question about those two elements.
Yeah. You know, I think the different cultures are full of misunderstandings, yeah? And there is something very strange that sometimes in art or culture, even the misunderstandings can be very productive, yeah, in an interesting way, and on both sides, yeah. And I think all our cities are products of these misunderstandings, yeah, and in many ways. And sometimes you can analyze them, and sometimes it is so mixed and goes back and forth and back again that you can no more analyze it. Yeah. So I can give how things are going back and forth. I can give one example. You know, this in Chinese opera, the classical opera, not the Beijing opera, the really Kung opera, the classical opera. You know, this movement that they are like on, you know, when they are coming on scene, I don't know if you know, this is like this, you know, they have a technique to walk like this. And I were always thinking why it is like this. And then when I saw the shadow plays, yeah, where they go, they don't go like this, yeah, they go like this, yeah. So you have first the puppets and the shadows, and they are doing this. And then it went back, yeah, to the opera, and they like to imitate this, yeah. And so things are always going back and forth, yeah, or like the car who has the form of the old what do you say, coaches. Yeah, coaches, and the columns, yeah, who have to imitate the old wooden things, yeah. And I think this is something very fascinating, yeah, how things are unbelievably constant, and sometimes they lose completely the meaning, and much later nobody knows why it is like this, but it is still made like this, yeah. And these are all things I'm getting very interested in, and with the time I think I am becoming a kind of just by curiosity, just to look at things, and kind of expert in how older forms are continuing in completely in a kind of travesty, yeah, into other things and move into other things. So these are things I'm interested in, yeah.
The lively archive. So I think a lot of the remarks that Ulrika just made are pertinent to the title of your book, Lost in Translation, the notion of productive misunderstandings. Perhaps we could bring you in on that track.
Sure. Well, I actually wanted to continue on with the idea of these objects and the way that they
seem to have some kind of life that is retained in them even when they're put in a different context. And there's this wonderful film by Alain René, Statues Also Die, in which he talks about the African objects that are brought into museums in Paris and how they die when they're put behind a glass case because they've been removed from the ritual context, not because they're, because in a way they've been made static artworks instead of living objects, and Still Moving reminded me very much of that film. And then I started to think, well, there's something similar that goes on with the animistic tradition that we see in Taiga with the shamanistic rituals, and in a way, that's also similar to what amusement parks are, because you have these automata and machines that move as if by themselves, and these puppets that move by themselves. And I guess I just wanted to ask you if you see that as a common thread in your work.
Sure, yeah. I maybe I'm an animist, yeah.
Well, of course, cinema is also about...
Of course, of course, it is. This is what the Prater also is. You know, the birth of cinema was at this kind of places. And so,
Just to build on the exchange that the two of you were having, in Still Moving, you animate the works that Homé is suggesting die within a museum through, in very surprising ways, both literal and metaphorical, and your memories, as you were just suggesting, are one of the animating forces. Do you want to say anything more about that? I think it's very interesting that we are very, we experience the animation, the vitality, without knowing the all the connections between the memories that are doing the behind the scenes work.
Sure, I think the memories are bringing to life the objects. And in this case, of
course... And also vice versa, don't you think?
Sure,
that the objects are bringing the memories to life.
Sure, exactly. Yeah. This is, of course,
Because I often felt while I was watching Still Moving that the people were animated by the things, that there was some astonishing kind of inversion that's part of the fascination of the work for me. Nora, can we...
I mean, just to shift a little bit, I was wondering, I mean, thinking about your work and, you know, as a filmmaker, but as somebody who was training to be an artist when you were in Paris, and what has increasingly become a very blurry boundary between artists and filmmakers, and also the fact that you have participated in several biennales. You were in two documentas recently. And so I'm just wondering, you know, so there's a context here of showing your work, and your work has had theatrical releases. And where do you see yourself institutionally, sort of as a filmmaker, as an artist? What is it, you know, because you really are still doing theatrical releases and not doing the gallery room, let's say.
Of course, I think films, I always prefer, of course, my films, you know, really the framing is so important, and everything, and the colors, and, you know, I'm really planning all my films like you are planning, I don't know, painting, or you are planning a mise-en-scène on stage, and also the locations are real, they get transformed through the mise-en-scène, so when the coal hills and the a flagellants going, and then you see I don't know, you can see an Renaissance image, yeah, and of the Quattrocento, yeah. So it is, for me, it is important that the films are seen at the cinema on big screen, yeah. But the reality has changed, so we just talked today about it. You know, in the I had my first presentation in the States, 79, 80, 81, 82, 83, and there all my films were to seen at the cinemas, yeah? And now, you know, these are more special places like Red Cat in L.A. or the Pacific Film Archive, or then Harvard Film Archive, or, you know, sometimes also at cinemas, yeah, but these are special events, yeah. And the time where Tiger, also it was more than 8 hours. It's an 8-hour documentary, but it's really fascinating. We're playing for 6 weeks in New York, sold out in a big cinema. Yeah. So, but you know, this has changed. Yeah, this situation has changed, and I think that the film business is. Doing a big mistake, yeah, to do all this conventional things, because the inspiration is coming from other people, yeah, and so I, in a way, I think it is. So now we have the galleries and the museums. You know, now some of my films are. Installations at MOCBA or at other places, yeah, in black boxes, yeah, and they are staying for 3 weeks. You can see Freak Orlando since, I think, 3 years in the museum and others of my films. But I still have more this retrospective. This is also more has this event character, yeah. And I think the film history is so amazing, yeah, and I think it takes just a little bit time, and then people will understand that they are losing a lot of opportunities, yeah, to see all these films. But I remember when I was in first time in China in 84, and I were filming one of these old operas in Chengdu. It was for 6 hours, and there was no heating. Also, it was below 10 degrees. And there was only some old people in this thermos bottles, coats, yeah, sitting there. And now all the young people in China, yeah, they are trying to find these people that they are still work, who can still work in this tradition. You know, there are always changes in the society. Yeah, and I think at the moment we have this only commercially oriented cinema, and but. I'm quite sure that it will change. I'm so old, and I saw all these changes, and so I think it there will be a moment when we have again, maybe not the cinemas, but another place where all these films are shown. Yeah.
Perhaps one of the, or all of the panelists would have something to say about that issue of the obsolescence of cinema, whether it is obsolete, whether it's morphed, the difference between looking at Ulrika's work in a cinema and looking at it in a museum.
The only thing thing that I would say is that it's a very different kind of globalized image that you present than we think of as, you know, sort of the accessibility of images of, you know, the elsewhere is so differently mediated now than you try to do in your movies, where you don't offer the context necessarily, but really make one look. So it would be a loss to not experience it that way, but I'm perfectly okay experiencing it that way in a museum if they're going to remain committed to.
They have a good projection, you know. I think this is what this world is, the commercial cinema world is not doing. Yeah, this is art world takes advantage. Yeah, this is, but if it is seen, it is all right. Yeah, so. It was quite interesting at the Shanghai Biennale. My film Exile Shanghai was shown, and it was subtitled in Mandarin. And I found it, so it was also a black box, of course, and I was thinking, so I put 12 chairs in. And when I went back after the opening, half an hour later, yeah, there were at least 80 people sitting on the ground, all young Chinese, and they didn't leave before the whole movie was over. So there is really, but this is different. They like to hear something about their history, and until now, their own history is interpreted by the Communist Party, yeah. In China, and it has nothing to do with real documents. They don't have access to this, so there you can explain it like this. But at the Shanghai Biennale, there were, of course, mostly artists at the opening because the other people could not go in. Yeah. So, but I found this quite interesting. So there are always a lot of surprises, yeah, you are facing, and this is good. So,
does anybody at the table want to? If not, I ask whether anyone in the audience has any questions or comments or further elaborations. Yes.
This is, I think the mirror is really an interesting, especially in film, and something very interesting, yeah, because it is trans, what you said?
Metacritical.
Yeah, and you know, in Bilden seiner Trinker, in Ticket of No Return, I of course the liquids are very important. Yeah. So, and the glasses at the same time have something very what you say hard. Yeah. So I. In Ticket of No Return, I were really looking for to find images for this really hard things, like the sound, yeah, of her stilettos, yeah, it's like the leitmotif, yeah, of the film, and also the glasses and this really. Heart and breaking surfaces are very important there. But in Prater, it is Zerspiegel.
Funhouse mirrors. Hmm? The magic, the distorting mirrors.
Yeah, this is distortion, yeah. And what in Ticket of No Return, the distortion is given by the water putting into the mirror. And at the Prater, these are this distortion reflectors. But I have also done it in Freak Orlando. All the this I made big photo series of it with Magdalena Montezuma of this distortion reflectors and mirrors. And at Prater, it is what you say, funhouse or fun?
Funhouse, where you
get this kind of. I think it's a very, what you call a Vixierspiegel.
Alex?
Several names have been mentioned, but I wanted to ask you, in the 1960s, when you were developing your filmic style, which after seeing a number of films, there's definitely at least one, if we separate the documentary, the straight documentary, there's a style that you developed, color and sound and the manipulation of stereotype, a number of things that you work with. Jack Smith has been mentioned, Andy Warhol has been mentioned. Who were some of the filmmakers that you were engaged with when you were beginning to make pictures?
Mm-hmm. You know, this is so different, yeah. You know, I have a great fascination for the German Expressionist film, yeah. And the very early cinema, I'm very fascinated by the early cinema by the Frère Lumière and then also Expressionistic cinema, that also, but then I got also very fascinated by the cinema of all this psychodramas, yeah? You wouldn't think I would like this, yeah? But this is something else than in our days, yeah? So it was much more complex, and it had to do with the time, yeah, of
what do you mean colors. By give us some examples of the cinema of psychodrama.
In the 30s, so I liked, by example, very much all the themes of Tennessee Williams and of Carson McCullers. And at the time, you had a lot of films who were working with this. Themes, yeah, and of Sherwood Anderson, I don't know whatsoever, yeah, and this I found very interesting, yeah, and then you know, the films I like, they are so different in a way, yeah, so. But of course, I liked the Stroheim and Sternberg films. I liked very much, yeah. And Murnau, of course. But all this I saw in Paris, yeah. When I went to Paris in 62, I always went to the Cinémathèque, yeah. I was one of the habitués at the Cinémathèque.
Yeah.
So I saw practically everything. I saw also the new American cinema, and then I liked very much the films of William Klein. They are not famous at all, but when I saw Qui et vous, Polly Magoo, yeah, from William Klein, I found this was fantastic. Yeah, then also Mr. Freedom, yeah, I liked a lot in Paris, and. of course, l'année dernière à Marienbad. Then, but I also got to know the new at the Cinémathèque, the new American independent experimental cinema, and I saw Kenneth Anger and Jack Smith for the first time in a night program in Berlin, where my two first films were shown at the same time. Yeah, and it was a wonderful cinema. It started at midnight when the last metro arrived, and it was over at 4:30 in the morning. And every night were an unbelievable crowd, and it was Flaming Creatures and fireworks and The Enchantment of the Blue Sailors, and my first two films, and Laocoon and Sons. Yeah, this was the night program, and it went for months. I went there with, I brought Susan Sontag there, and some other people, a lot of Americans also. I brought there. So it was fantastic. So I saw for the first time the films, but I knew about Jack Smith, yeah. And I knew, of course, of Kenneth, but this was in, I don't know, it must have been in 75 when I had made these two films.
Can I ask a related question?
Yeah.
In the film of Lil Picard's birthday,
yeah.
Is that Paul Swan wearing the blonde? Who is the man who wears the wig that looks like the blonde Venus wig?
This is a gallerist, famous gallerist from Berlin, Mr. Springer. Yeah, it's a famous gallerist. And there were all these art people around, the museum directors and everybody. Yeah, so.
Any? Yes.
The first two things you said that your films begin with locations, and you refer to yourself as a flaneur.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear you talk a little bit more about your flannery, and particularly within the context of the streets in Prague.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think if you like to do a film, you have to look carefully at the surface of things. Yeah. And they are telling you everything. Yeah, you have just to look at it. Yeah, and to understand, to read it. Yeah. So if I'm going through, this morning I was for 3 hours flaneur in Philadelphia. Yeah. And if you look at this, so it tells you a lot. Yeah, it tells you when the city were prospering. You see it at the architecture, and of course I didn't see every part, yeah, in this time. But you hear the music who is coming out of the restaurants and the bars, and you look at the people, and you understand a lot, but you have really to watch the things carefully, and you have to learn, you have just to learn to read it. So this is how it start everything. Of course, then you add a lot of other things. Yeah, it's not only this, but often the idea, the first idea comes from a location, or you go at a place and you see, this is unbelievable, this place. It tells you a whole story. It has not, and then when you do research afterwards, yeah. So, by example, now I'm doing a vampire movie, yeah. And so it started with all these unbelievable locations in Vienna. Yeah, so you have the Tower of the Fool. It was the first place at a time when the crazy people was still, taken away and so. So it is an unbelievable building. And then you have all these caves, yeah, where in one the heart of the emperor of the Habsburg, yeah. They had three times they were buried, yeah. This only the Habsburg could develop this idea, yeah. And so the heart is there. Then the eyes and the intestines are at another place, yeah. Then the bones are at another place. So it is so unbelievable, yeah. So, you know, you have just to go with all these stories, yeah, and then you have a wonderful screenplay, yeah. So, so this is what I mean. You start with all this and you think, what kind of weird idea, yeah, to do this, yeah? But then you go back in history, and finally you understand why it was made, yeah? And maybe you don't understand, but and then you have what you know, of course, what is famous, all the important landscapes, places, yeah. If you go in a landscape in Mongolia and the mountains are holy, yeah. So you see there's a mountain who looks like an altar, yeah. So you know this is an old place. You can find the same thing on the Canarian Islands, yeah. And they have even the names of, they called Lofre, yeah, the mountain, what means offer. Yeah, offer to gods. So you know it is. Then they built a church there. Then all the pèlerinage takes place. Yeah, to this. So it's very interesting with locations. Yeah, there are places who have something. Yeah, and it is seen by everybody in every time. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, exactly what you were just saying. Each of your films is so culturally dense and rich, and so much starts with one place. You tend to focus on that place. How important is it for you, for your audience, to know or not know those references?
It's not important. I think they feel it. This is what I'm really thinking. Yeah. This is how people feel about a place that it's somehow interesting, yeah, or somehow has a certain Ausstrahlung, a certain
shine, shine.
Yeah.
Certain,
So you feel like, as an audience, for example, in Mongolia, we get a lot of it regardless of whether we know about Mongolia or not, just by the richness of what
we do. Yeah, this is. You know, there is people who go through the streets and sees nothing, and other people, they are seeing something, so, you know.
I'm struck by the credits in Still Moving, the objects that appear.
Yeah.
The objects that appear in the order of their appearance, yeah. Which is a fascinating anthropomorphization or personification of the objects, and
yeah.
Which I think is an accurate credit. Given the role of the objects in the work, I'm wondering if we couldn't say that your films are the locations that appear in a certain sense, too. You know what I mean? That Vienna could be credited as the city that appears, and hopefully Philadelphia will one day be in a credit,
yeah.
And the film will be called Philadelphia's Story. If there aren't any other questions, I think we should thank Ulrika and the panelists. And
thank you.